The new book, The Partisan, The Life of William Rehnquist, is the first full biography of William Rehnquist, the influential Chief Justice whose conservative vision shaped the current court and moved it decisively to the right. Following John Jenkins' 1985 profile of him in the New York Times, Rehnquist vowed never to give another such interview, and until his death in 2005, he never again spoke so openly about his background and ideology. It's a great pleasure to welcome John Jenkins to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
What brought you to want to flesh out that piece that you first worked on in the mid-1980s? And take a look at obviously a lot that happened from 1985 to his death 20 years later.
Well, the Chief Justice and William Rehnquist in particular occupies an enormous position of importance in our political system and in our country, and the Chief's role and Rehnquist's role in particular is just very not well known. I think it's interesting that the Supreme Court, even though we have four justices who probably are going to be stepping down in the next 4 years, the Supreme Court has not been an issue on the political spectrum by either candidate at this point, and it ought to be. And so, as a journalist, my interest is always going past the do not enter signs. All right, and Bill Rehnquist, when he was Chief Justice, put in effect a very big "do not enter" sign at the front of his life and at the court. And to a journalist, not just me, probably, but anyone with the wherewithal to get at the story, that's a challenge. And I also felt that it was just a very, very important book and timely, given the importance of the court in our political system.
Did you feel at the time, in 1984 when you interviewed him, in 1985 when the piece came out, do you feel that you captured him?
I certainly captured him as well as anyone would be able to. He was not necessarily an introspective man. At least he didn't really abide journalists or reporters or anyone asking him questions about his life. And so, yes, I felt that I really captured a side of him in my Times interviews that hadn't previously been seen. But it wasn't really until I started digging into his papers after his death, and they became available. Rehnquist died in 2005, and his papers became available in 2008. And it wasn't until I started digging through those 359 boxes of papers that are out at the Hoover Institution at Stanford that I really felt like I was getting a look at his inner life, going all the way back to his time in college. So I certainly felt that as I began to research the book, that I was getting a much better picture than Rehnquist by interviews alone had given.
I think his background is fascinating because I just assumed that he would have come from an Ivy League background, very humble roots. So was he somewhat of an outsider coming in to the court?
He was an outsider not only because of his humble roots, but also because he came there with a very decidedly conservative ideology that was unusual. When he first got to the court, he was a clerk in 1952 and 1953, and he was very, very much taken by the Supreme Court as a hallowed institution. But he quickly found that he was isolated in terms of his political ideology. He had come to the court as an extreme conservative. Today he would be a libertarian. I don't know that term was even in use or in vogue in the early 50s. So Rehnquist, when he first came to the court, was very much the outsider. And when he came back to the court in 1971 as an associate justice, he was a young man, 47 years old, nominated by Richard Nixon to be by far, at that time, the youngest man on the court. He was also, by his own design as well as by his ideology, a lone ranger. In fact, to the point where a few years after he got to the court, his clerks gave him a little doll that was a doll of the Lone Ranger. At that time, the movie was coming out. It was reprising the television show from the 1950s, and Rehnquist was very proud of that. He actually was proud that he was standing up for beliefs and for an ideology that he did not think were well represented on the court at all.
So is being an outsider, he liked that, a bit of a loner of being able to be outside of the quote-unquote system and operate somewhat autonomously from it, I would think.
Yes, absolutely. But he's a complex guy, okay? So even though he styled himself as the outsider, and he was proud of it, and in his papers there is a letter to his mother reminding her on the eve of his taking the job as Chief Justice that his mother and father taught him to stand up for himself and to be that fiercely independent person. So even though he does that, yes, absolutely, when he comes to the court, he also, I think, cares about how he's perceived. He's touchy about it. So, you know, like all of us, I suppose, he becomes, when you see his papers and I think you read the book, a much more complex person than just the right-wing ideologue that that he also was, but he was also had a much more vivid inner life going on.
So you ask him the question point blank, are there any memorable opinions that you have? Are any memorable decisions that come to mind? And he doesn't have an answer.
No, he doesn't.
That says a lot.
Well, because it's, I'm, you know, honestly, I don't know. We shouldn't probably call him out too harshly on this because I think if you were to ask many of the justices, they, either because they're humble or because they really truly don't believe that the cases are as significant as we on the outside think, they, you might get that answer from others, not from everyone, but perhaps from others. But in Rehnquist's case, he was absolutely being just flat out honest about that, and because Rehnquist was what I in the book what I call a situationist. In other words, he looked at the case as it came before him. He looked at what at it, as he said, as it showed up on the doorstep. And he almost instantly, using his own instincts and his and the prism through which he saw political things that were political, his own ideological prism, using his own instincts and his long-standing ideology, he could almost instantly make a decision and write a very, very quick opinion or dictate an opinion or the context of an opinion for one of his clerks. And so he got his work done very, very fast. And he was, he almost, I don't know whether your listeners can appreciate this, but he almost, he'd never been a judge. And he almost acted more like a trial court judge than an appeals court judge, if you understand the distinction. Somebody that's trying the case on the merits as it comes before him rather than looking at precedent. He didn't believe in applying precedent. He thought that was a sham. And so I think at the end of each case, it was just like draining a big bathtub. He got steeped in the case, in the facts of the case, but not so much the law. And then once the case was over, he moved on. There certainly were things that he stood for time and again. He stood for the imposition of the death penalty. Okay, he stood for fewer rights for the criminal accused. But when you asked him about the cases like that, he just said, "You know, they're just kind of like a long gray line." That was the expression he used when I interviewed him in 1984. They're just like a long gray line. They all sort of blend into each other. When you think about it, at that time, the court was deciding 120 cases a year. Of course, he was there 31 years.
You say that he, in determining his opinions, it was on a basis of, quote, what seems to be the better point of view. What did he mean by that?
He thought that when a case, by the time a case got to the Supreme Court, there were things that could be said, meritorious things that could be said about both sides. After all, Rehnquist said, there wouldn't, if it were an easy case, it wouldn't be before us. So by the definition of the kind of cases that the court took, every case, almost every case that came before him was not easily cut and dried. There were things to be said on both sides. And so he just would weigh the evidence. And at the end of the day, it was kind of like, where is the majority of the evidence? Where is the preponderance of the evidence in this particular case? Again, almost like a trial court judge. And by the way, he enjoyed leaving the Supreme Court bench and going into the hinterlands and sitting occasionally as a trial court judge. He liked that because there were clear wins and losses and very decisive acts that then, and you could just move on. So the better point of view in Rehnquist's mind was where the preponderance of the evidence lay in a particular case. 51% to 49%, he voted with the 51%.
When you look at the political nature of our country, the political polarization, and obviously we see great polarization in the court. As you mentioned, here is a man who served on that court for 32 years. And at the beginning of his time, the court was not as divided as it became up until his death, and certainly in the time since. Given the political shifts, given the justices that were added and the ones who passed, how much of a role do you think he had in the shaping of the partisan court?
The role that Rehnquist played, I don't want to overstate it, but the important role that Rehnquist played was not in the selection of other justices, obviously, because he studiously avoided that. And even when he was asked his opinion, for example, by Ronald Reagan, when Reagan was talking to Rehnquist about becoming the chief, Rehnquist studiously avoided attempting to influence the president in who else should be put on the court. So Rehnquist's influence came very importantly from making it acceptable to be a partisan. When you think about acceptable to be a partisan, in other words, he stood up for the principle and for the concept that a justice could bring his political point of view to the court and did not have to abide by stare decisis, or in other words, the Latinism meaning deference to precedent. That was a very, very significant thing. There was a justice on the left, William O. Douglas, who saw it the same way. And these two men, by the way, and I talk about this in the book, that's just, to me, was one of the most fascinating things to learn. These two guys actually became friends, and Douglas became a mentor to Rehnquist. So even though they were at polar extremes ideologically, they both saw their role on the court the same way, which was to make very, very quick judgments about the cases before them based on the ideological prism that they applied. But Douglas had always been so far out of the mainstream. He hadn't really made a case for why his version of judging should become the dominant one. Rehnquist, just by sheer force, by sheer intellectual force, and the man was potent intellectually, and by his writing, and by his insistence on coming back again and again to originalism and the notions of the founders. Okay, so he was grounding that partisanship in something. Douglas wasn't. Rehnquist was. That became acceptable, and a whole gamut of judges that began to get appointed in the years after Rehnquist to the district court and then to the federal courts of appeals, including some that are now on the Supreme Court, patterned themselves on Rehnquist. Even though one might argue that, I think successfully, that some on the current court have surpassed Rehnquist, both in their partisanship and in their ideological purity. But Rehnquist was the first, and that was the importance that he played.
First and also made it acceptable, right?
He made it acceptable, absolutely. He defended it, and as I said, when the night before he was to be sworn in as the Chief Justice in 1986, he wrote to his mother and he said, I've done what you and Dad always taught me, to stand up for what I believed.
You write in the book, I think it's one of the most fascinating chapters in the book, about the Clinton trial, the trial of President Clinton and, of course, the articles of impeachment. How did he view that and his role in it?
Rehnquist had he didn't view his role as particularly an important one. Politically, it was ceremonially, it was very important, and he really took that seriously. But Rehnquist believed that it was really up to the senators to do their job, and in fact, he had an opportunity very early on by making a particular ruling on a procedural motion to determine whether or not he would be able to inject himself into the partisan debate, or whether he would defer to the Senate, allowing them, in essence, to vote on their own rules. In other words, Rehnquist could have imposed judicial rules on the Senate, or he could have had the senators vote on it. And he wanted the senators to vote. He allowed the senators to vote. He made a ruling from the rostrum that was how it was to be handled. And in so doing, he actually took himself more out of the debate. But I think that was very cagey. I think it was very shrewd on his part, because he did not, Clinton was not convicted, and there was, if Clinton had been convicted, very unlikely, everyone knew going into it, if Clinton had been convicted, and Rehnquist was at all to have had a hand in it, I think that he just would have, that would have been not kosher from his standpoint. He also, Rehnquist, in the years after the impeachment trial, as he was going through his desk, he found some tickets to the gallery that he had not used. He had been given tickets to give out to members of his family or friends to sit in the gallery and watch the beginnings of the proceedings. And as you might imagine, those tickets were probably very, very valuable. He sent them to his children, and he asked that they be saved for his grandchildren, because he said they might be worth something someday to someone. But I think that he viewed his role as a facilitator to what he thought would be an obvious end, and indeed the end was exactly as he thought it would be. He didn't think Clinton, by the way, would even be impeached.
He did donate his robe to the Smithsonian.
Yes, he did. He took a tax deduction for it.
$30,000.
Yep, he had it appraised by Sotheby's and took a tax deduction for $30,000.
From his papers, from your investigation and look into it, do you think he had any regrets in the role the court played in Bush versus Gore?
I don't think that Rehnquist had any regrets whatsoever about Bush versus Gore, particularly. That was a purely an ideological, partisan decision. But that was exactly the kind of decision that Rehnquist had no problem with at all. Interestingly, for Rehnquist having made the comment in a letter to his son at one point that stare decisis, the honoring of precedent, was, quote, a sham, unquote, and he thought that all justices really in their hearts believed that, even though he was the one willing to say it. The court in Bush versus Gore also made clear that was not a precedential holding. There's actually a provision in the opinion that it may not be cited as precedent. I think it's interesting now, as we get down to the final days in the current campaign, to think about what happens if a case gets tossed into the court again. But I have no doubt that when it came to Bush versus Gore, Rehnquist, his conscience was clear.
And that, of course, and to end our conversation, is when you look at Chief Justice John Roberts, who clerked for Rehnquist, what influence does it seem that Rehnquist had on him?
John Roberts, I call in the book, I call John Roberts the logical heir to the natural heir to Rehnquist. I don't think there's any doubt. You know, Roberts clerked for Judge Alfred Friendly in New York before he came to Rehnquist. It's very possible, we'll know someday, but it's very possible that that Roberts' ideology was also fully formed by, as Rehnquist was, by the time he got to the court. The one thing that is clear in terms of Roberts being the natural heir is that John Roberts, Affordable Care Act notwithstanding, is an even more conservative jurist than Rehnquist right now. And the court as a whole is even more conservative under Roberts than it ever was under Rehnquist. And that is not just my opinion. That is, those are the findings of learned scholars who actually are charting and mapping the relative conservatism or liberalism of various courts going all the way back to 1939.
The name of the book is The Partisan, The Life of William Rehnquist. It is published by Public Affairs. John Jenkins, a great pleasure to have you share with us this morning. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Partisan, The Life of William Rehnquist, published by Public Affairs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.